I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today we're going to have a conversation about saving gas. Should we open a window or use AC? Idle or turn off the car? But first, let's have the latest from Iowa, where they have much bigger concerns. The flooding that hit the northern and middle part of the state is moving downstream along the Mississippi River, which won't crest for days, meaning the worst is still to come. As residents brace in southern Iowa, National Guardsmen hope to fill 500,000 sandbags to fortify levees in Illinois. In Iowa, the New York Times reports that fields of corn and soybean look more like rice paddies than Midwestern plains. Joining us for a live update is Kay Henderson, news director for Radio Iowa. And Kay, we know that Cedar Rapids, Des Moines, and Iowa City, you know, may have seen the worst of the flooding. The waters may be receding there. But what is this thinking about downstream?
They are bracing for the worst. As you mentioned, the crest on the Mississippi along Iowa's southeast border is expected to reach that portion of the state on the 18th of June. Places like Burlington, where they have dispatched National Guard troops to, as you mentioned, conduct sandbagging efforts. One of the real telling, numbers facts about this whole situation is that last Thursday, there were 640 Iowa National Guard soldiers on flood duty around the state. Today, there are 4,000.
Is that a sense that, you know, maybe they were late in coming, or just the increased, you know, crisis and the continuing crisis?
The nature of the rolling crisis, if you will. At the end of May, Iowans were dealing with some pretty severe tornadoes, which struck in the north-central part of the state. And it seems as if for the past 3 weeks, Iowa has just been getting swamped with storm after storm after storm.
And Kay, let's be clear, because people outside of Iowa, you know, still aren't, judging by what some people have said here, that, you know, do Iowans consider that this is a part of their storm system being built poorly, you know, as in New Orleans, that, you know, that the levees might not have been built strong enough? Or is the sense that this is just because there's so much more rain than anyone anticipated?
I think there is a sense that it's Mother Nature's fault. Looking at a map of the city of Cedar Rapids, which among all Iowa cities was the hardest hit, the Cedar River courses through Cedar Rapids. We were shown a map, reporters, at the State Command Center yesterday, which shows that the Cedar River flowed beyond what hydrologists consider the 500-year floodplain. So this is of historic proportions, the flooding that's occurred in Cedar Rapids and Iowa City, which is home to the University of Iowa, where they have a performing arts center which has flood up to the stage.
What's been the economic impact? We understand that the crops in particular have been infected.
Well, last week the governor of Iowa started using the B word, as in billions, and that is plural. 20% of Iowa's corn and soybean crop is either rotting in the field or farmers never got it into the field because of the wet conditions during planting season. So to have 20% of the state's two largest commodity crops endangered certainly doesn't bode well for the state's economy. And, of course, Iowa usually is the top corn-producing state in the country.
So we know last week the price of corn rose above $7 a bushel on the market for the first time. Soybeans shot up. And we understand a further problem is, you know, as heartbreaking as that is for farmers to lose their crop, now there's the problem of standing water, manure, cattle, all the problems that come down the road from having this much water.
Exactly. And while Iowa's economy does have sectors such as financial services and large-scale manufacturers like John Deere, certainly agriculture is a main anchor in the state's economy.
You've made an observation that 36,000 residents have been displaced in the area. But how many stayed in shelters, and what does that say to you?
Well, yesterday we were told by state officials that among those 36,000 Iowans who had been evacuated from their homes because of floodwaters, only 472 stayed overnight in a shelter on Saturday night. There are 18 Red Cross shelters established at various cities around the state. And again, only 472 people. What that tells you is that people have transportation to a friend, a neighbor, a relative somewhere else in Iowa to stay. I think that is a very fascinating statistic.
Of course, and post-Katrina,
right.
people were trapped in the
right.
in the city of New Orleans and could not get out.
And what has been fascinating about this rolling disaster is that state officials have urged Iowans to evacuate when told not to try to stay behind with their property as floodwaters rise. Michael Chertoff, the head of Homeland Security, was in Iowa last week, as was the FEMA director. We're told that President Bush will be making a trip here as soon as he returns from Europe.
Kay Henderson, news director of Radio Iowa, thanks so much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the latest impact of high gas prices in the U.S. may be a spike in stranded drivers. In the last 2 months, the CVS Samaritan Van Program, which operates in the Midwest and on the East Coast, has helped 40% more stranded drivers. AAA in the Mid-Atlantic region reports a 14% increase. More people may be running out of gas as they try to squeeze the last few drops out of their cars, but officials say that some drivers aren't running out. They're hoping to get the free gallon that comes with a rescue. Pretty drastic measures, but they aren't the only ones. A group of drivers calling themselves hypermilers claims they can double their gas mileage with some not-for-everyone steps, like coasting in neutral, turning off their cars at stoplights, and drafting behind big trucks. Is that safe? And what does work? Paul Eisenstein is editor of thecarconnection.com. He joins us for a conversation about saving on gas. And Paul, these hypermilers also pop the clutch to start their car. They never use their brakes. So first of all, what do you think of this Uber attempt to cut down on fuel?
At one level, I appreciate it. It's good to see people trying to find new ways. The problem is they can also be both a safety hazard and just an irritant to the rest of us. You see people who will sit in traffic. They won't inch forward, and all of a sudden they have three cars, car spaces in front of them that they won't fill. Other people jump in. They will get in the left lane doing 45 miles an hour, even when the traffic is at full speed. And they can actually waste everyone else's mileage.
Well, let's just walk through some of the things that they do. For instance, they say pop the clutch to start your car, like, you know, kids used to do back in the 50s and 60s. What do you think of that?
I don't think it's a very good idea. For one thing, it can actually be damaging to the car. You don't really want to be doing that to the clutch. You can wear it out a lot more quickly. Plus, you're rolling the car down the street or down your driveway where it may cause a problem. You can lose control of the vehicle, and you can cause damage to somebody else.
Okay. How about never hitting the brake? I mean, these are people who, as you said, they drive very slowly, but they will just try as much as possible not to use the brake. Now, does using the brake increase your fuel usage?
Anytime you have to use the brake, you are obviously wasting energy. The momentum, inertia, if you will, is being transferred to heat energy, which the brakes waste. They're constantly cooling off from airflow. So in a sense, yes, you're right. If you don't have to hit the brakes, don't. People who tend to approach lights very quickly and then slam on the brakes are wasting a maximum of gas.
Now, why did you rush up to that yellow light that you know is going to turn red?
Yeah, a lot of people don't like to slow down until they have to. On the other hand, again, some people, I had one on the way to the airport who was just sort of coasting down. First of all, people cut in front of him. Secondly, he has a whole line of people behind him who are hitting brakes and wondering what he's doing. Sometimes you might not even know if that person's brake lights are working, so you might worry about whether or not you're going to hit him.
Yeah. So that's your thoughts on not hitting the brake. How about this? These hypermilers turn the car off, like when they come to a stop sign or a red light.
In a sense, they're not doing a bad thing. There are some studies out there these days that suggest if you're idling as little as 30 seconds, you'll waste more gas than you would if you restarted your car. But the reality is, if you are on the street, if you're in traffic, you're in any situation where the people behind you could be blocked if, for example, your car doesn't restart, don't do it. Maybe if you're in a very slow line at the bank, but don't shut your car off. Unless your car is able to shut itself off, don't shut it off at a stoplight. That can be dangerous, and it can create all sorts of problems, particularly if for some reason your car doesn't restart and all of a sudden cars have to run around you.
Well, you say these hypermilers, they not only turn off their car at stop signs, they turn off their car while driving, like 50 miles an hour.
First of all, if you shut the car off entirely, you can have your steering wheel locked up, remember. And even if you don't, let's say you suddenly need to make an evasive maneuver. If the car's shut off, you aren't going to have the time to go and restart it and try to power your way out of a problem.
Well, and they do say on some of the websites, this is not for everyone. How about drafting behind big trucks? You're out there on the highway. Get right behind, you know, a few feet behind a big truck and just ride their tailwind.
That's a great idea if you don't mind the idea that you may become the equivalent of a fly on his tailgate rather than on his hood.
Yeah, because you could, if they stop suddenly, there's an accident.
You don't know. First of all, you never know if the car in front of you or truck in front of you is well-maintained. Do the brake lights work? If they hit in an emergency, how good are your reflexes? These days, the brakes in most cars are pretty darn good, but all you have to do is blink when you're drafting somebody that close. And if they hit their brakes hard, you're going to be merging into that truck.
How about some of the other, you know, commonly held beliefs about saving gas? Leaving the AC off is always better.
No. In fact, in many cases, leaving the AC off is worse. It's really nice to open the windows if you can when you're just cruising around at a slow speed. When you're getting up to highway speed, an open window will actually have worse mileage because aerodynamics are so bad. I mean, airplanes have made aerodynamics work for them tremendously. They save massive amounts of fuel by doing things like tucking their wheels away. Well, doing things like putting little underpans under a car can save a mile or more a gallon.
What do you mean underpans?
Smooth out all that stuff that's hanging underneath, like your
mufflers,
mufflers and the like. Ford Motor Company put what's called an air dam underneath the bumper of their new F-250 pickup truck, the one coming out in 2009. Just this little piece, it's, you know, a couple square feet altogether, will save them over a mile a gallon. Another thing, which, listen, there are a lot of truckers still out there, and a lot of truckers, you'll find, will drive with the tailgate down, thinking that if they do that, the aerodynamics in the bed will be better. In fact, they're worse. Keep the tailgate of your pickup truck up, and the wind will flow smoothly over the bed. It won't actually go in there and churl around and slow the car down. So sometimes what you think are common sense solutions really aren't.
Give me some more of what you think really does work.
Cruise is very good on the highway. It smooths out your driving.
You mean the cruise control?
Cruise control. But if you're using cruise control in very hilly places or conditions where the car is constantly getting back on the engine, getting the gas back on, it's actually going to use more fuel than if you just use common sense and a soft foot. I heard something recently that I found quite interesting. Some people are suggesting you drive barefoot because
what?
You will have a better feel for the gas pedal than you would with your shoes on. I haven't tried that yet. I've done it before, and it's not comfortable for me. There are some very important common sense things that have to do with maintenance. Now, there's been a debate on how often to change your oil. Some people change it too often and actually wind up throwing out a lot of good oil. Probably don't need to change oil every 3,000 miles. Check your instructions. Check your manual. But somewhere short of 10,000 miles for sure, and usually 6,000 to 8,000, will be best on your engine. The engine will last longer, and you'll probably have less internal friction, get better mileage. Tires. I call tires the Rodney Dangerfields of the automotive industry. They get no respect. If they're underinflated, the tire's going to wear out more quickly. You're going to have less grip, and you're going to have a more dangerous ride. And you may increase your fuel consumption by as much as 20%.
20%?
Yes.
So underinflated tires will increase your consumption by 20%. That's amazing.
They can do as much as 20%.
Wow. Paul Eisenstein, editor of thecarconnection.com. We've been talking about getting the most for your money at the gas pump. We also want to ask if, you know, switching to hybrids, which is great for the environment, it does make economic sense for people. But first, some basic tips. Paul, we mentioned oil changes, whether to use air conditioning or not, and tire pressure. Does changing clogged air filters improve gas mileage?
Oh, definitely. Filters should be changed on a regular basis. You should get a tune-up. An engine that is not running well is going to burn more fuel. Check your manual. Always think about how well you drive. Oddly enough, you can drive from here to New York if you're not stuck in traffic.
And we're in Boston, to remind our listeners. Yep.
And you can wind up putting less strain on your car than a couple days of driving 5 or 10 miles each way in heavy traffic.
Really?
Because you're stopping and going. The engine's never warming up. You may never get the catalytic converter to the temperature where it will clearly and effectively clean up the pollution that's coming out of your engine and so on. Yeah. The oil will wear out more quickly, so a lot of short trips are not good on a car.
When you make that long trip, though, does it really matter if you go slower?
Well, we talked about aerodynamics, and obviously the faster you go, the harder you have to push the air out of the way. There are other reasons why a car is going to burn more fuel as well. I've heard different numbers, and it does depend on the type of vehicle, the aerodynamics of the vehicle, and so on. 60 to 65 miles an hour will typically be, for most vehicles, pretty much the optimum speed that people can drive on the highway and not get just frustrated. There was a AAA report the other day that said for every 5 miles an hour above 60, you effectively are spending another 20 cents a gallon on the additional fuel you're burning.
If drivers were to do, you know, a checklist of things that you mentioned that work, like not idling and shutting off the engine, inflating the tires to the right pressure, cleaning the air filters, not driving up around 80. You know, the list went on as you told us. And by the way, we'll have it on our website, here-now.org. With gas over $4 a gallon, how much can you save?
It's hard to say exactly how much it would work out. But let's say you had a car that was out of tune, your tires were underinflated, and by the way, studies have typically shown at least a third of the public, sometimes half, will have tires that aren't an optimum pressure. You're doing the wrong things for aerodynamics. Maybe you have the windows open on the highway.
Right. You're doing everything
and
wrong.
And so on. Everything wrong. You could wind up wasting 30, perhaps even 40% of your fuel.
40% of your fuel.
30 to 40%. Now, that's an extreme. You've got to be really doing everything wrong. You've got a cylinder misfiring on your car. You need a tune-up desperately. You haven't changed your oil. Your tires are bad and so on and so forth.
Have you been in my car lately? I mean, you know, it just cost over $50 to do a fill-up. So you're saying like $20 of that maybe is wasted.
It's conceivable. Even the average driver, just by using simple tricks like inflating tires and so on, can probably save a couple miles a gallon without becoming some of these hypermilers that are taking risks, putting other people at risk in the process.
And by the way, you're here in Boston to test drive a what?
A Bentley.
And what's the gas mileage for the Bentley?
Well, are we talking about when I put the pedal to the metal and use up all 500-something horsepower? Or if I'm driving the way I've been recommending? You can get as little as 12 to 14 miles a gallon if you're pushing it hard.
Man, and people are still buying those.
Actually, sales of those are falling about as fast as sales of the latest pickups. But it's funny, when people have the money, they'll drive it. What I'm finding is happening right now is an increasing number of the people who can afford these luxury cars, or even sometimes the trucks, are winding up going out and buying, maybe they'll buy a Bentley or an Aston Martin or something pedestrian like a Mercedes-Benz. Mm-hmm. And they'll also buy a Prius or even something, one of those little mini cars. I've seen people whose driveways have had Mercedes and smart cars.
Well, we're hearing that if you have a gas guzzler, it's really hard to take it off your hands. It's really hard to get someone else to take it. It's really hard to trade it in.
Right now, you're seeing that the trade-in values on some of the biggest and most fuel-guzzling cars may be down by 10, 15%. It's not unusual. That's something that you try to trade in right now, say a big F-Series pickup or a Chevrolet Silverado. You might get $2,000, $3,000 less than you did just 6 months ago. Hmm. One of the things that is very important to keep in mind is to sit down and do the economics. There are two things that you have to be looking at when you're thinking about what you're going to do with your car, particularly if you're thinking about trading in something like a hybrid. Sit down, look at the real-world mileage you're going to get, and start doing the economics. For example, let's say you're looking at the Ford Escape Hybrid. This is something that one of their own engineers told me the other day. He said, for most people, it doesn't make a good economic case to buy one of these. You're paying perhaps a $5,000 or $6,000 premium, and you may save $400, $500, $600 in gas annually. So you'd have to keep the thing for 10 years to make up the difference, even at $3, $4, $4.50, even $5 a gallon. When you go to trade in your big SUV, you may save a few miles a gallon, but if you've only had the car, say, for 2 years, you may owe so much on the loan that you'll actually have to pay money to trade it in.
Well,
you'll be
course,
what's called upside down.
Well, and of course, for some people, it's still worth it because it's better for the environment, maybe not as good for the pocketbook. And in looking around at some of the hybrid cars, the mileage isn't that much better.
No, that's the thing. The hybrid has become the poster child for the quick fix. Yes, there are some hybrids. The Prius gets pretty good mileage, though not as good as it originally promised when it was saying 60 miles a gallon. The feds have redone the tests, and now it's down in the mid-40s. And if you look at some of the hybrids, there's a couple Lexus models, for example, in real-world driving may actually get no better and in some cases worse mileage than the gasoline version. I'm a big proponent of diesel. I know there are arguments against it, but there's a new generation of super high mileage clean diesels that are just coming to the United States. And for people who are driving in a variety of conditions, not just stop and go, but may do some highway time where hybrids don't do very well, some of these new diesels are actually the solution. And we're going to see even more creative solutions out of the auto industry over the next few years.
But again, there are two bottom lines. One's your pocketbook and one is the environment.
Absolutely.
Paul Eisenstein, editor and founder of thecarconnection.com. Paul, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, we're going to take a look at the majestic bluefin tuna, the world's most desired fish, as in sushi. And that's made it the most endangered. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, Canada apologized to two Native Indians for a century-long school program. The mandate was to kill the Indian in the child. That's after the news. Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Today we recognize that this policy of assimilation was wrong, has caused great harm, and has no place in our country.
That's Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, at times choking back tears, as he formally apologized last week for the century-long program that wrenched Native Indian children from their families and put them in abusive, church-run residential schools to implement the government's stated policy to kill the Indian in the child. Parliament apologized in 1998, but Native Canadians said that wasn't enough. They launched a class action suit, won a $2 billion settlement, and the promise of a reconciliation commission that last week began its work. The Indian Residential Schools Truth and Reconciliation Commission has a five-year mandate to hear from school survivors across Canada. Here in the U.S., brutal boarding schools for Indian children weren't officially authorized by the American government, but still, Indian groups have long asked for an apology, and Senator Sam Brownback introduced a resolution that's in a bill before Congress. But now Canada will begin hearing from survivors of school abuse. Justice Harry Laforme is the chair of the commission. He's also a Mississauga Indian from the Mississauga of New Credit First Nation and the first Aboriginal person to sit on a Canadian court. He joins us now. Justice Laforme, welcome.
Hello.
We understand upwards of 150,000 children attended these schools over a course of 100 years. Did you attend one, by the way?
No, I didn't, and that was probably more by good fortune than by design. But a lot of my relatives did. So,
well, what were they like? What is known now about what happened there?
What used to take place, and it was lawful to do so, was to go in and remove children from their homes and take them miles and miles away, where they wouldn't see their families, their mothers and fathers, starting at the age of 6 or 7. And then these children would never see their families all year long. They would stay in these residences, be forbidden to speak their language, be forbidden to practice any of their culture or traditions, and basically try to learn to be white people.
Look, the U.S., the United States doesn't have a great track record here either with its Native American population. There were schools in America where Indians' children were not allowed to speak their native languages. But we hear that in Canada, in these residential schools, children were given numbers, their names were taken away.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of physical and sexual abuse because it was such a ghettoized experience.
Yes. When you set up environments like this for the most vulnerable of our society, which namely are our children, you can almost rest assured that an element of abuse will find its way into it. That just seems to be, and that happens in modern times as well. And down there it was. The question remains, how widespread was it? And we've got data that suggests that it was very widespread and, in fact, was more of the norm rather than the exception.
Well, and some are pointing to the current state of Native peoples in Canada, that many experience alcoholism, depression, unemployment. Tell us more about that.
Well, we are, as Aboriginal people, invariably at the low end of any socioeconomic scale, including poverty, death rates, disease, low life expectancy, all of it. And one of the things that we know that has been a real thorn in the side of resolving that issue is a relationship issue that starts with original contact. And that relationship issue is now, I think, can be defined as one of mistrust, of fault, of power, inability to share that power, and a balance in terms of discussing resolution to those issues. And we think that residential schools is a classic example of how that relationship that we currently exist in became so fractured and unworkable and full of such mistrust.
Well, the Canadian formal apology follows Australia's formal apology to its Aboriginal people. Although there are no reparations included with that apology, several states here in the U.S. have made formal apologies to blacks for the era of slavery, but there's been no formal federal apology to either African Americans or Indians. How much, first of all, did that formal apology from the government, you said how important it was. Why?
Well, I think it's got many aspects to it of why it's important. And, I mean, I was there during that apology in the House of Commons, which was full of people that have been affected by this issue and, more to the point, survivors. And you could see this was had an incredible impact on those people that were there. National Chief Phil Fontaine, who represents and probably is the face of Aboriginal people in this country, and was a residential school survivor himself in every sense of the word, you know, with the abuse issues and all of it, and elegantly and as passionately as he could, viewed that apology as commencing a healing process. And I think he was right. And each individual will decide how much that apology means to them to start any kind of healing or invoke any kind of healing for them. Some will no doubt reject it outright because who knows what their pain and their hurt is. For the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, it means that one very, very big aspect of the truth is already there. We now have to fill in some blank spaces and concentrate on the reconciliation, which may even be a more difficult component.
Well, Justice LaForme, could you briefly tell us what you plan to do? Because there are upwards of 90,000 survivors of the schools. Are you expecting to hear from all of them?
No, I don't think that would be possible. Not everybody will want to come before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And I can tell you this, our job becomes even more complex and more difficult when we talk about the truth has another side to it. The truth has the churches and the government of Canada who participated in this during that period of time, too, which we've got to gather information from, which we've got to hear from and get their side of the story.
Do you plan ultimately, as happened in South Africa, to make it public?
Yes. Yes, we do. I mean, one of the things that we know is reconciliation, of course, really requires full knowledge of the truth, full acceptance of that truth, and then some action. And some commitments to move this in a different direction. And one of the interesting things, and you raised it with your question, is this comparison to South Africa. We're different than any other commission that has existed in any other country up to this point. And our difference comes from the fact that we were created, mandated by court order in this country. We get our life from the courts, not from the government of Canada, not from a provincial government, not from the Aboriginal people, but from the courts and any issues. And within that court structure, in that court order, if you will, is a promise and a guarantee by the churches and the government of Canada to cooperate fully and give us free and liberal access to all the documentation.
That's Justice Harry LaForme, the new chair of the Indian Residential School Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is about to begin its 5-year mandate. He's also an appellate court judge in Ottawa, Canada, and a Mississauga Indian. Justice LaForme, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Okay, a quick note about some of the stories in the works at Here and Now. We'll look at the fundraising machines of John McCain and Barack Obama. Obama's is online. McCain is on the rubber chicken circuit. Also, people still ask Pierre Delay, what did it all mean? We'll have a fascinating conversation with the actor about making the film 2001 Space Odyssey. That's later this week. You're listening to Here and Now. Did you know that plants can pass gas and burp? It says so right here in Science on the Loose, Amazing Activities and Science Facts You'll Never Believe. It's a new book for kids, and Helene Becker is the author. She joins us from the studios of the Canadian Broadcasting Center in Toronto. Welcome.
Hello there.
Gassing, burping plants?
Well, if you think about passing gas as releasing gases into the atmosphere, certainly they do. We know they give off carbon dioxide as part of their respiration process. But they also produce different kinds of gases that can actually work as pesticides or pest repellents. So if you, for example, are an aphid and landing on a particular plant, it might give off a puff of gas that smells to that pest as something horrible.
It's fascinating. And speaking of gas, let's just get right to it. Some parents are going to find this disgusting. Others are going to realize what a great way, you know, to get kids to do experiments. I'm referring, of course, to
the famous fart experiment.
Yes. There actually was a study in Australia, as you write, that tried to determine if baked beans really make people, as you write, fart. And more to the point, if girls fart more than boys do. So take us through this study, and what do kids learn from it?
What we usually talk about is how to find out. And through that, the kids learn about the process of setting up a scientific experiment, how you need a hypothesis to start, how you set up an experiment and design it.
In this case, they have to recruit friends willing to report back what happens after they eat beans. The person doing the experiment charts and graphs the results. And by the way, girls do pass gas more. But the important thing is kids learn process. And they also learn other really interesting factoids from your book, that yawning is infectious, and that may be because it evolved as a signal to alert a pack when it was time to sleep. Animals can be identified by the colors their eyes glow in the dark. A cat's are green, for instance, a crocodile's spooky red. Let's do one of your experiments. It's called Lost in Your Space. Tell us more about this.
In order to function in the world, you have to know where your arms and your knees and your nose is to calculate how you're going to get from space A to B. How your brain does that is a bit of a mystery, but you can see it in action with this activity, and all it needs is a jump rope.
Well, we happen to have a jump rope right here. I'm going to stand up, okay? So just bear with me. So what am I supposed to do with this jump rope?
Take the jump rope and you throw it down on the floor so it makes a big circle.
Okay.
And you have the two ends next to each other so that you can grab them.
Okay.
So you pull on the two cords to make that circle shrink until you estimate it's the size of your waist.
Okay.
And when you think it's the size of your waist, then you step into the circle, grab where the two rope ends cross so that it doesn't change size, and lift it up around your waist and see how accurate you were.
Oh, it would be two of my waists.
You just found out what most people find out when they do this experiment, that they think they are much, much bigger than they really are. Now, why does this happen to everybody? If you are going to err on your size, it makes much more sense to think you're bigger because you're less likely to get injured or caught if you pull yourself to a smaller space.
Huh. Let's do Aristotle's crossed fingers. Now, what do we do and what do we learn?
Aristotle came up with this 2,000 years ago. And what you do is you cross your fingers, and you'll notice there's a little V between the tip of your fingers at the top there. And close your eyes and put a pencil in between the V. With your eyes closed, rub it. If you don't have a pencil, you can do it on your nose.
I'm running a pencil up and down the V, and I feel like I'm feeling two pencils.
That's weird. And there's a very good explanation. Normally, those two fingers lie in a different position than when they're crossed, right? They're next to each other. And if you put the pencil or your nose in between there, your brain knows that is usually between two fingers. There's probably one object giving sensory input to each of the fingers. So if something is touching the outside of your index finger and the outside of your middle finger, your brain knows that under normal circumstances there would have to be two objects.
Yes.
So when you switch the position of your fingers, your brain still reads two inputs on the outside of the fingers, two objects.
Isn't that something? You can fool your own brain.
Your brain is fooling you all the time, because if your brain actually spent a lot of time figuring out the details of everyday life, it wouldn't have enough time or energy to actually think.
That's Helene Becker. Her book is Science on the Loose, Amazing Activities and Science Facts You'll Never Believe. It's a lot of fun. Helene, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And next up, an experiment in healing the bitter divide in Cyprus. That's in 1 minute, here and now. In 1974, the island of Cyprus was divided between Greek and Turkish Cypriots, Turks in the north, Greeks in the south. There'd been a civil war. Turkish troops arrived. Greek Cypriots saw them as invading forces. The Turks saw them as protection. Blood was let. An effort to force a power-sharing government didn't work, and so a line was drawn across the island, a sometimes violent division that remains to this day. While the UN attempts to unite the two governments, two musicians, one a Greek Cypriot, one a Turkish Cypriot, hope to unite their country in song, using instruments and lyrics from both the Greek and Turkish traditions. That's from the CD Music of Cyprus, the brainchild of Turkish Cypriot Mehmet Salnikol. He's a graduate of the New England Conservatory of Music here in Boston and president of the group Dunya, which seeks to promote Turkish culture and music to the public. He joins us in the studio. And joining us by phone from Cyprus is Greek Cypriot Theodolos Vakanas, also a graduate of the New England Conservatory. He worked with Mehmet on the CD. Theodolos, let's start with you. This division between Greeks and Turks on Cyprus isn't on Americans' radar, but it's very, very deep. So how was it to befriend each other?
The thing is that the project's main cause is to show that the music is united.
But when you meet each other in America, at an American school, is there a wariness? Is there a discussion you have to have? I mean, how deep is the division?
We both experienced the feelings of our families or, you know, people who live in Cyprus. But the fact of the matter is that we were able to get to a level where we were able to do this collaboration. And I don't think we see each other as Turks and Greeks. We see each other as friends and Cypriots. And I remember my grandma, who was a Turkish Cypriot, who would sit and stand up saying Kyrie eleison, which is a Greek, you know, Orthodox Christian thing to say. My dad speaks Greek.
Theodolos, do you hear the same thing from your relatives there?
Yeah, exactly the same thing. I mean, a lot of words we are still using in the Greek Cypriots still use some like Turkish words, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the music and the similarities in the music. You describe it for me. How would you describe Turkish Cypriot and Greek Cypriot? Start with Mehmet.
The Greek Cypriots often include the lauto. And the Turkish Cypriots will often include the oud. The instrument then unites the two is the violin, and the unique Cypriot way of playing the violin.
Well, let's listen. The CD is divided into wedding and love songs. Mm-hmm. The love song includes track 4. It's got a different title in both the Greek and the Turkish versions. Do you want to help me out here?
Dolama is the Turkish title. Nasugoraso Mihanin is the Greek title. Was that good, Theodolos?
Yes, Nasugoraso Mihanin.
There you go.
Now, Mehmet, while we listen, is this a song that you would hear at weddings in both Turkish and Greek Cyprus, or no?
I think till, I don't know, 2 decades ago, maybe even till like 10, 15 years ago, yes, I think this was very, very much played at Turkish weddings, and I would assume the same thing goes for Greek weddings.
Yeah, the same thing. 10, 15 years ago, these songs used to be played a lot, and as time goes by, the younger generation tends to forget tradition. Usually now in weddings, they tend to play more like modern kind of Greek or Turkish music. And it's like a traditional dance, actually. So some dancing groups are still using this song to show this kind of dance. But they don't really play this in the weddings anymore.
Well, you mentioned dance songs. Mm-hmm. And we have another cut that is specifically a dance song. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm relying on you, Mehmet, to help us with the pronunciation.
Sure. The Turkish pronunciation is orak. Tomasairin, is that correct?
It's tomasherin, which means the knife.
Exactly. And orak kind of means the knife, is a different kind of knife. But both the Greek and the Turkish Cypriot accents, dialects, have a unique sound of their own. So I'm able to speak the Turkish Cypriot accent, but clearly not the Greek Cypriot. So that's why I keep asking for Theodolos'
help. That's okay. Let's listen to The Knife. Theodolus, how did this project go along? I mean, there you are in the studio with Mehmet. Did you ever, you know, were there points where you said, well, actually, that's not how my family did it? So how did you come up with the sound?
Actually, what we did is that we played both versions, the Turkish Cypriot way and Greek Cypriot way. So you can hear in a few songs that, for example, there is a phrase that is longer or shorter is in the Turkish or Greek version.
Can you give us an example of that?
Well, I think the best one is number 15, right? Dilirga, tilirkotisa.
Yeah, it's dilirga, and in the Greek it's tilirkotisa, which in the Greek version, one of the phrases is repeated twice each time.
Turkish version basically cuts it short. It cuts it half just because the lyrics don't need it. But it's really the same song. And an ordinary listener, I don't think, will even notice that. A Cypriot will notice the difference.
You've both said that this is not a political project. It's not as if you think this is going to spackle over 35 years of deep division. But do you think that someday Cyprus will be reunified?
Who knows? If people start talking to each other, you know, at least something about Cyprus, you know, something about those past 500, 600 years, you know, will be reunified. Hmm. Not maybe the entire island. You know, maybe, who knows? You know, change is the inevitable thing, right? Sometimes it happens in a bad way. Sometimes it happens in a good way. But, you know, it's like, it doesn't matter. As long as there's something that is out there to remind us of some of these nice stuff that happened in the past.
And I have to say for our listeners, as you said that, you picked up your CD and looked at it and held it in this affirming way. You know, there's something out there like your music.
Yeah. And, you know, in the end, Robin, what matters the most, I cannot picture myself, Mehmet Sanlıkol, not knowing Theodolos Vakanas.
The same applies on my side.
That's Theodolos Vakanas, a Greek Cypriot speaking from Cyprus. We've also been speaking with Mehmet Sanlıkol, a Turkish Cypriot, here in the studio. Their CD is Music of Cyprus. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. And Mehmet and Theodolos, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.